Group meeting, Saturday, 17th April, 1982. I think it would be useful to bring back to mind what is our purpose here with these meetings. Our concern is not to study, merely to study comparative religion. Our purpose is not just to indulge our intellectual nature, to discuss and argue highfalutin, sublime things and so forth. The rest of the world can do all that, because all that sort of thing is the result of the pleasure drive in people, the pleasure drive and the egoistic drive. I go to this group, I go to so-and-so's meeting and so on. Our concern is with the living of the religious life. The living of the religious life for us does not mean merely subscribing to a certain set of doctrines and dogmas and beliefs and systems of philosophy, religious philosophy and so forth, nor does it merely mean going through all sorts of rituals and paying worship in the conventional sense. Does not mean all that. It means that we shall live wide awake with all our senses active, observing ourselves all the time, and observing in the right way, without any helpless reaction to whatsoever we observe. In other words, to live very mindfully, in the true sense of the word. Not with the purpose in view of entering the kingdom of heaven or realizing nirvana or something. No one in the world will ever enter the kingdom of heaven or realize nirvana. But the kingdom of heaven or nirvana can shine through the person who lives so mindfully, so cleanly and purely that transcendence itself manifests its transcendence as the perfected human being through this particular individual. That is our concern, you see. So, all the usual sort of nonsense associated with groups and societies and so forth is out of the situation altogether. We mean business, in the real sense of the word, divine business, you see. And there are no profits, there are no gains whatsoever involved in the divine business. We have to remember that. The purity of the individual, the morality of the individual is the basis of all religious living. Absolute basis. It's an indispensable basis. And we must be well aware of that and remember that if we seek if we are concerned with soul living, that transcendence can fulfill itself through us, then if we make any mistakes with regard to this purity, with regard to the objective we may have in mind, that will bring very unpleasant results to us ourselves in the first instance, and our families, to those around us, and so forth. There has to be the complete elimination of all selfness. The complete elimination of all selfness. Don't equate this with the ordinary conception of unselfishness. Unselfishness there will, of course, be. In the ordinary way. But that is in a worldly context. And very often, unselfishness is something which is imposed upon us by external circumstance or which we impose upon ourselves because it satisfies our vanity and egoism. I am an unselfish worker for humanity. I serve God, forgetting all the time and that I'm more likely to serve the devil that way than to serve God. However, so if we bear all that in mind, then we shall appreciate what our real concern and purpose is. And it is in the light of that sort of outlook, I'll say, not an ideal, but an outlook, that we try to consider things here and order our lives accordingly. This is very important. I think in all the great mysticisms of the world, you will find this sort of thing emphasized and presented fairly well. But as the centuries go by, the uncompromising nature of this presentation becomes more and more intense. I always say, and I've said it quite openly and absolutely in the heart of religion, there is nothing whatsoever for me. If there is anything for me, then all efforts at living the religious life are bound to end nowhere, more or less. I'll only be deceiving myself that I have progressed along a spiritual path. I don't progress. It is transcendence itself. It is the supreme, it is the one total reality which comes to fruition through me because I remove the obstacles in me to that fruition. Unto God the glory, so to say, you see, and that is absolute. Nothing for me whatsoever. And that has tremendous implications. Do you realize that? Tremendous implications. All our ordinary ideals and conceptions of how to live and so forth just go by the board if one really sees that. Because if you examine your own ideals, as I had plenty of ideals in my young days, but now in my old age, at last, after about 60 or 70 years of constant study, practice, observation, and so forth, I see that our ideals are self-oriented. I desire to attain this, that, or the other, to do this, that, or the other. This is the difficulty with ideals. Who makes the ideal? I, the imperfect man. I set up an ideal. I project out of my brain, by means of wishful thinking, what I believe is desirable. Desirable for others, maybe, but desirable for me, certainly. Therefore, it is all fundamentally based upon a selfish outlook. You see? So, to be free of this is to take perhaps the most important step in the realization of true freedom. And then there is peace of mind and peace of heart. Then one doesn't feel, oh, I failed here, I succeeded there, and all the rest of that rubbish. The whole of the, all the criteria which are involved with our dualistic thinking and behaving disappear then. That's the freedom you get. And in that freedom, transcendence will function through you. You can't prevent it. Well now, with that little introduction, let us go on to one important point, at least, for consideration. Those of you who were here last time will remember, that is last month, March, will remember that we spent the meeting, our time, in considering the significance and implications of the silence and the importance of the silence. You may recall I pointed out how our ordinary thinking process is just a string of words. We can be silent with our tongues, silent as far as audible speech is concerned. But we cannot be silent as regards our inaudible speech, which is the continuous activity of the brain that goes on. You see, that is the great disturber of the peace of God and the peace of man also. This inaudible chatter that goes on constantly and which is almost invariably and almost completely centered round one's own self. You see, that just goes on and on. There is only one state in our ordinary everyday life, and every human being in the world does experience it, is when we are in deep, dreamless slumber. In our ordinary physical waking state and in our dream state, this chatter goes on continuously. It is the confusion maker, it is the deluder, and so forth. But in deep, dreamless slumber, this chatter has at last quietened down, just for a few hours during the night or whenever we go off into truly deep slumber. Now, the Upanishads pointed out very carefully that in this state, what is called the Atma goes back to his own. Of course, language is a very troublesome thing altogether. One can find fault with practically all the statements in all the scriptures. The Atma goes back to his own. And the mass of the people of the world who know the word Atma, think of the Atma as my Atma, my immortal soul, the spark of the divine in me. Now all that is nonsensical thinking altogether. The transcendent, the infinite, the eternal, the immortal, functions wholly and completely through each and every single object or person throughout the entire cosmos. From an atom to a galaxy, from a virus to a perfected holy one, the infinity, eternity, immortality, transcendence functions totally and completely through each and everything. Now, as far as I'm aware, please correct me if I'm wrong, because after all, I know that I don't know. I don't think this has ever been sort of stated categorically before, that the totality of the infinite, of the transcendent state, functions through each and every finite temporal and mortal thing or person, all the time. But its function, you may remember, I have often said, transcendence never compels. And one of the many implications of that is transcendence never intrudes upon us. You see? Transcendence never compels. That is the reason why the mass of human beings throughout the 3 or 4 million years we've been on the globe are so unaware of the fact that they themselves are embodied transcendence. All we have got to do is to wake up to it. Until we wake up to it, we have not realized true humanity. We are not truly human. We are subhuman. Subhuman, the word sub, not meant in an insulting or derogatory sense, far from it. This is the simple fact. I am the ordinary man in the world. I am a subhuman. I am growing towards full humanity. And whatsoever is thought, felt, done, seen, understood, realized, which brings this person towards that full humanity is religion. That is religion in the great sense. You know the simple meaning of the word religion, deriving it from the Latin religare, which Servius, Lactantius and St. Augustine presented as the reintegration into the source from which we emerged, from out of which we were expressed, we were brought into being. That is religion, therefore, you see. And you will see, therefore, what religious living implies in our ordinary everyday life. This person who ordinarily is conscious only in terms of the temporal, the fleeting, the impermanent, the mortal, the finite, you see, the imperfect, has so to grow that he becomes conscious of that which is transcendent, which is infinite, eternal and immortal, in full consciousness. Now, the meaning of full consciousness must be grasped by us. You know how when, say, an artist, let us say a musician, is absolute master of his instrument, and when he plays, and you look at him, you say, oh, he's absolutely lost himself. Quite true. He's lost himself, that means not lost in the sense of losing your wallet or penknife or something like that, but you have completely transcended confinement to limited existential being. You see? You've completely grown out of that, at least for the time whilst you are performing. Completely lost in the transcendent. So now, it is in that way, in that sort of way at least, that we have to become conscious. Now, many people will say, well, he's so master of his instrument, he plays unconsciously. No, he doesn't play unconsciously. He plays with complete, perfect consciousness. His whole being is so utterly wide awake to the reality of the music as such, he's so completely at one with that music that he is actually recreating in the full sense that which was created by the composer. Now take another instance. An infant is born. It can hardly move apart from the ordinary involuntary movements. Then come the different stages. It begins to crawl. Then it begins to toddle. Then it begins to walk. And in all these processes, there is a certain amount of stumbling and falling and all the rest of it. Plenty of laughter and plenty of shouts and tears and whatnot, you see, which is all very lovely. And then comes the stage when he or she walks quite easily and can run. And when he can run, he never has to think about how to run. He just runs. The whole body just runs, you see. Now that is the complete, final, concrete expression of consciousness. Consciousness no longer needs props and memory aids in order to function. Now, when we function as the blissful, happy creator, which is the true meaning of the word human, you see, when we function that way, then at last we are true humans. Now, of course, you might say to me, well, but you are presenting a terrific ideal. I'm not presenting any ideal at all. I'm only stating what I see for myself in this matter. You see, this is what I see for myself. I myself see this as being so for all human beings. I don't mean I see it just for this particular human being. You get it? Now, what happens then when one, through living the religious life in the true sense, the perfectly mindful life, the life which brings harmony throughout the entire existential being, the element of silence plays a greater and a greater part. You see, there is the silence not only of speech, but of audible speech, but there is the silencing of that chatter which goes on in the brain constantly, which is the noise maker in the universe. We are awful interferers with life, and we are awful noise makers, cacophonous creatures we are, spoiling the harmony and the music of the universe as such. Of course, your ordinary scientist will say, music of the universe indeed. Our instruments which have now recorded the sounds which come out of galaxies and distances is just a sort of a hiss. So it is. But is that the whole universe? The manifested universe? Because the manifested universe, in a sense, although it is transcendence embodied and an expression of transcendence, is also an obstruction to transcendence. Because the manifested universe is unawake to transcendence. It is in the state of the deep dreamless slumber. It doesn't know anything about transcendence. When you and I emerge out of our deep dreamless slumber, we don't bring back that transcendent state into full conscious activity here and now. You see how it is. So now, this silence begins to play a greater and a greater part. And as we all know, our ordinary inaudible chatter consists of words. It may consist of visual images. It may consist of oral consciousness, or the memory of touches, tastes, smells, etc. Or it may consist of just so much discursive thought, logical discursive thinking processes, which are concerned with scientific or philosophic matters, or whatever they may be, you see. Now, each word represents something which is finite, either as an object or a person, or as an event, or as a situation, or as a quality, or something like that. But all the words of all the languages in the world represent, in actual fact, that which is finite, temporal, and mortal. All words represent that. And that is the ordinary manner in which we are all conscious. Now, if and when this stream of words stops, in what manner are we conscious of the universe, of existence? Our mode of awareness with all those words going on is the mode of mortality, because it begins, it proceeds, it dies. It's the mode of mortality. If and when that mode of mortality ceases altogether, the brain is completely quiet, but you are awake, you're fully conscious, and that consciousness is non-descript. You can't describe it. You cannot use words to describe the non-verbal state. You see? You have to experience it, realize it. So, in what manner are you conscious now? You are no longer conscious in the mode of mortality. Therefore, you have entered the mode in consciousness, in full awareness, the mode of immortality. Some of you, many of you, I don't know, you may have sometime or other in your life experienced that overwhelming immensity of the transcendent, suddenly enveloping you altogether. That's what most people call the mystical experience and so forth, you see. You may have experienced that. But when you experience that, you won't know with the brain that, I am experiencing this. When you experience the reality, when the particular existential being experiences transcendence, then it is an unknowing experiencing. It is an unknowing, fully awakened consciousness. A very strange thing to say. Because we are so accustomed to think and believe and function in terms of knowing with the brain. Oh, I know this, I don't know it. When I say I know this, what do I mean? I have a whole set of words to express certain mental pictures, certain thought forms. Call them principles, laws of nature, call them what you like. But they are just words, words, words. And words by themselves are impotent. Somebody asked me the other day, you say words are impotent, but look at St. John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now think carefully. What is God's language? Can we send a wireless message to Him in any language of the world? God represents the supreme, ultimate, creative energy at work, manifesting throughout the universe. It's an energy. All right. The mind of God, and in the Hermetic writings, you get a real hint as to how to understand this. In the Hermetic writings, it is stated that the thought in the mind of All Father God, and All Father God is equated with All Father mind, again, you see, is the meaning of the Logos. That is the Son of God idea, you see. All right. So the Logos, the Word, and Logos means the Word, you see, is actually a creative energy. That is why in Genesis, and in other scriptures too, God said so and so, and it was so and so. He never said anything. I prefer to use the word minded. In Genesis, for instance, Elohim, and Elohim said. No, and Elohim minded, because mind is this formative, order-producing expression, archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy. And Elohim minded, let us create, not make. Your mechanic makes things. God's not a mechanic. He doesn't belong to any union either. Let us create man in our own living likeness. Now you see what the word man really means and can mean. Now that state, that transcendent state, is a completely silent state. There is no noise there. It's utterly peaceful. That is why we have phrases like the peace of God which passes all understanding. And you talk, the Buddha, for instance, talked of the sublime, unoriginated nirvana. You see, the utterly peaceful, the supreme peace, which therefore is not merely the opposite of noise or any sort of sound. It includes, it subsumes all noise and all that we call music and so forth. You see? It's like that. Now that silence one experiences when one has allowed the inaudible chatter in the brain to calm down. It is like this. You get a storm. Our ordinary state is like a storm outside. But every storm comes to an end. I can't do anything when there's a storm outside. I just have to let it work itself out. And there is a great secret. Nature is a wonderful teacher, really. Perhaps the most wonderful teacher. You have to just wait until it subsides. Watch it. You'll enjoy it. You'll be happy being buffeted about by the storm. You see? You'll get wet, but keep cool, and it'll be all right. You see? The storm comes to an end. And have you noticed how wonderful that peace is which succeeds the storm. It's absolutely magical. Now the same thing, not the same, but a similar thing, a comparable thing, happens in one's own psyche. The psyche is the noisemaker and so forth. All right. Watch that noise. It will subside. And when it comes to the point where it has really subsided, because you yourself in your inner being are still and quiet, then this awakening into the wordless condition appears. You have emerged out of the consciousness, mode of a consciousness of mortality, into the mode of consciousness of immortality. Now, why do I say immortality? Because, do remember, immortality does not mean time forever and ever and ever, that I exist forever and ever. Never. It will never be like that. And it would be the great, one of the greatest tragedies in the universe if any I persisted throughout the universe. So immortality means non-mortality. You know how the Buddha used the term deathless. He never used the term immortality. He used the term deathless. It is the deathless state. The state which doesn't destroy, which doesn't get destroyed, which doesn't decay. It's the idea of decay which is important here, you see. It doesn't decay. All right. So in that state, there is this perfect peace, and you experience the non-dying state. Because with that peace, with that quiet, nothing uprises in the psyche, in the brain. The brain has ceased to chatter. Therefore, nothing uprises there. Therefore, if it doesn't uprise, it cannot proceed and it cannot die. Whatsoever uprises necessarily proceeds and dies. So this realm of mortality itself, because of complete consciousness, complete awareness, and the perfect observation of it, ends up as really as revealing immortality. You never attain or achieve immortality. Immortality is revealed to you because you have transcended mortality in your own being. Now do realize, it's a mistake to say, I realize the immortal. No. The I has disappeared altogether. The I is the obstructor of the light of transcendence. You see? If I draw those curtains and shut out the sun, well, there is no light coming into the room from the sun. Isn't that so? Now, transcendence is like the sun. And I am just something which veils the light of transcendence. This separate self, this self-oriented, separate, isolative self-consciousness. This is the great obstruction. That is why the organism as such is not to be not to be wrongly evaluated. We all evaluate ourselves wrongly, don't we? We think we are very fine fellows. Oh yes, of course we are. Undoubtedly. We are wonderfully fine fellows because divine potency, divine potentiality lies locked up within us. Our potentiality is transcendence itself, God himself, if you like a theistic word. You see, that is our potentiality, our divine potential. And that has to be allowed to manifest itself. Allowed to manifest itself, because it will never compel us. All that will happen to us, if we don't allow that potential to come out, is that we will suffer pain. Suffering comes to us because of that. You see? So now we see the importance of this silence. And this silence comes fundamentally through pure watchfulness. Remember Jesus' words, watch and pray. For ye know neither the day nor the hour when the Son of Man cometh. The Son of Man, the word man means mind, from the Sanskrit man, the root man. The dictionary gives only the limited meaning of it, which is very misguiding. To think. Man, the root, the Sanskrit root man, they say means to think. And of course we imagine therefore that it means this inaudible chatter that goes on in the brain all the time. Nothing of the sort. It is mind, this universal archetypal energy, which is the formative influence which shapes the cosmos, ultimately. So now, in the living of the religious life, this silence is of the utmost importance. And if we have that silence and carry it out in our practical everyday life, we will be free of all our self-obtrusiveness. Watch, we have to watch ourselves, watch society as it functions. All the time, individuals composing society are obtruding themselves upon their environment and upon all other people. And so we have this ghastly, sorry tale told by an idiot of all the ambitions and envies and jealousies, hatreds, violence, stupidity, and so on of mankind, haven't we? Therefore, as the Buddha said, samasati, sama samadhi, the supreme togetherness, the supreme unity. And you will find that you yourself as an existential being, no longer obstructing transcendence at work through you as the perfected human, the Holy One, will be a benediction to the world in which you live. Thank you.